Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. The orders of the court will be pronounced by Justice Spears.
Orders on causes. Harvey Donworth at Ux versus Preston II Chrysler Dodge, Inc. from Dallas County. The judgment of the Court of Appeals is reversed and the cause is remanded to that court. Opinion by Justice Spears. Concurring opinion by Chief Justice Phillips, joined by Justice Gonzalez and Justice Cook. Concurring opinion by Justice Ray, joined by Justice Mosley and Justice Pat. Responsive Terminal Systems, Inc. versus Boy Scouts of America from Dallas County. Pursuant to Rule 133B, Texas Rules of Appellate Procedure, after granting the application for writ of error and without hearing oral argument, a majority of the court reverses the judgment of the Court of Appeals and remands the cause to that court. Per curiam opinion. H.W. Mitchell versus MKT Railroad Company from Fort Worth County. The judgment of the Court of Appeals is affirmed. Opinion by Justice Cook. Dissenting opinion by Justice Ray, joined by Justice Mosley and Justice Doggett. Dissenting opinion by Chief Justice Phillips to be delivered at a later date. The following motion for leave to file petition for writ of mandamus is overruled. Gary Lee Smith versus the Honorable Frank Sullivan, Judge from Tarrant County. Mr. Chief Justice, that completes the reading of the orders.
Thank you, Justice Spears. One cause has been set for oral submission this morning. It is Edgewood Independent School District and others versus William Kirby and others from Travis County. The court has allotted 55 minutes for petitioners to present oral argument, 1 hour for respondents to present oral argument, and 20 minutes for petitioners to present rebuttal argument. The proceedings today are being videotaped. This is an unusual procedure for my court, for our court. Let me explain why. These procedures are being videotaped by personnel of the State Bar of Texas at the request of the court. This videotaping is being done in conformity with Section A9C of Canon C of the Code of Judicial Conduct. The filming will not involve moving camera personnel or extra lighting to distract participants or impair the dignity of the proceedings. All parties have consented to the videotaping. There will be no exhibit of the videotape until after all appeals in this cause have been exhausted, and the videotape will be exhibited only for instructional purposes. The court is now ready to hear oral argument from petitioners in this cause.
May it please the court, Mr. Albert Kaufman will present the first 35 minutes of argument for petitioners at Edgewood ISD.
Good morning. We are here today to determine whether the Texas Constitution requires the legislature of Texas to treat people equally, especially to treat students equally, and to meet the legislature's constitutional duty to establish a suitable and efficient school finance system. I'm Al Kaufman with Mexican American Legal Defense Fund. We represent the plaintiff's petitioners here. I'm joined by Mr. Richards and Mr. Gray representing plaintiff interveners. Altogether, we represent 68 school districts with about 400,000 students. Procedurally, this case was filed in May of 1984. An amended petition was filed in March of 1985. It was tried over a 10-week period with 8,000 pages of transcript, 40 witnesses, yards and yards of exhibits. Judgment was entered in June of 1987. Where Judge Clark of Austin ordered the state to come up with a constitutional plan for the system of school finance by September of 1989, to begin the implementation of that plan in September 1990. The court, the defendants appealed that to the Court of Appeals. In December of 1980, the Court of Appeals found for the defendants, and we have perfected this appeal. That's why we're here today. As I said, we are here to discuss the future of the children of this state, and probably no more important issue will come before you in terms of the interpretation of our state constitution. The issues are, does the system created by the legislature guarantee equal rights, or does it give a set of men exclusive public privileges? has the legislature met its mandatory duty to provide a suitable and efficient school finance system? Has the legislature denied privileges and immunities to the plaintiffs without due course of law? And can this court decide these issues? The defendants have challenged the power of this court to do so. In my argument, I'm going to outline first how the system works, how it affects human beings in this state. We'll look at the language of the Constitution to see what guidance that can give us in interpreting the legislature's actions. We'll look at the equal rights provision under Texas law and talk about your cases and other states' cases. We'll look at the efficiency and suitability of the system, due course of law, and the attorney's fees issues. First, the facts. The district court opinion in this case constitutes the facts of this case. Those facts were challenged somewhat in the Court of Appeals, but the Court of Appeals reversed none of them. So the facts found by the district court are the only ones before you today. In the district court's findings, of course, they are crucial, but in addition, you have to consider them in light of the district court's findings on the state's justifications for this discriminatory system as weighed against the interest of the plaintiffs. And under your case in TSEU in Texas of 1987, you determined that the state's justifications, the weighing of those against the interest of the plaintiffs, is a fact issue to be determined by the trial court. In this case, the trial court determined that this system of school finance is irrational. It's not efficient. It denies equal educational opportunity. That the denial of equal educational opportunity is not based on any rational consideration of policy. The district court determined that the system is not suitable, it's not adequate, and the state justification of local control is insufficient to rebut the interest of the plaintiffs and the suspect categories into which they fit. We're going to look at the system now as a whole, pointing out that the district court did exactly that. The district court looked at the system at the extremes and looked at the system in the middle. It looked at the system any way you want to cut it, and it found it discriminatory under each system. The state spends about $11 to $12 billion a year on schools in the state. 42% of that is paid directly by the state and 49% by local districts by the use of local property values. There are 1,060 districts in the state. 600 of them have less than 1,000 children. There are 3 million children in the state. The average wealth in a district is $250,000 per child. The importance of that, of course, is that that is the tax base on which local districts can provide an education for their children. That is what they go to, both to meet the mandates of the state and to provide whatever other educational offerings that they can. The average expenditure in the state was $3,300 at the time of the trial, and the average tax rate was 66 cents. In terms of wealth, the district...
Excuse me. We're talking about student area 586.
That's correct.
All these
findings. That's correct. The range of wealth at that time was from $20,000 a student in one district to $14 million a student in another district. But again, the district court didn't look just at the extremes. He said that if you look at 1 million kids here in the richer districts and 1 million kids there in the poor districts, these children have 2.5 times the wealth to draw on than the children over here. The state has classified human beings, the state has classified students into categories based on districts and has determined that these have much more access to the wealth of the state than do these.
Counsel, how does this, these facts changed or altered by the last legislative session funding for education?
They're really not altered at all. The system was a very small change in the last session. Didn't even meet inflation from 85-86. There are no major changes in the structure of the system at all, and an analysis of it shows that there's simply no changes to affect the issues before this court today. If we look at the 300,000 children at the very wealthiest districts, they have 25% of this state's wealth to draw on. The 300,000 here at the bottom have 3% of the wealth. In terms of expenditures, they also follow a similar range, from $2,100 a student in some districts to $19,000 in another. But again, the district court did not look just at the extremes. He looked at this looking at the top 5% and the bottom 5%, the top 10 and the bottom 10, the top 20 and the bottom 30, 20. And each comparison, top to bottom. Each comparison, the children in the poor districts suffered. They had less resources and their taxes are higher. In fact, the 150,000 kids in the richest districts have twice the expenditures as the 150,000 poorest districts. Now, in some of these issues today, we're going to talk about differences in expenditures of $100 or $200. That might seem minimal, but it's not, because $200 a student translates into $4,000 in a classroom, which means you can offer higher salaries, you can have more teachers, you can have more supplies and better buildings, even on $100 or $200 a student. When you're talking about the difference between $6,000 and $3,000, you can tell the difference in the provisions that a district can make for kids. In terms of taxes, the taxes in the poor districts are higher than in the wealthy districts. Often when someone sees this problem at first, they can say, well, the problem is people in the poor districts don't care enough about their kids. They don't raise their taxes. If they really cared, they'd raise them. In fact, they're higher. The poor districts pay higher taxes, and they get less for it, and they really have less incentive to raise their taxes than do the people in the wealthy districts. In terms of an $80,000 house, and this is in the record, if you live in Crystal City, you have an $80,000 house, you pay $1,100 a year taxes. If you live in Iran Sheffield, you pay $38 a year taxes. If you live in Iran Sheffield, you have two or three times as much spent on your children. Again, these children are all residents of the state of Texas. Our position is this is a state system of education. We have up before you the Constitution of the state of Texas, and it says that. It says it's the duty of the legislature. The legislature treats children differently, and it hurts the children. Now let's look a little bit at a combination of some of these factors. If you look at the 50 poorest districts, they average 72 cents tax and spend $2,900. If you look at the 50 richest districts, they have 37 cents tax and spend $8,700. Again, they're two different groups. To use the constitutional language, there is a set of men that has been given special privileges, special emoluments, and people are not given equal rights under the Constitution.
Counsel, Judge Clark, in his opinion and findings of fact, defined adequate education as the educational program available to the 600,000 students in the wealthiest school districts. In other words, this should be the same standard as applied to all students. What sum of money would the legislature be required to appropriate to meet that standard?
That depends completely on the amount of the burden that they lay on the local school districts. If there's no change at all in the system, it would be a fairly expensive proposition. If you worked it out so that all of the people in the state shared equally in the burden, it would not be very expensive because you would not have the inefficiencies that you have in the present system.
Under the current system, what dollar amount are you talking about?
I don't have a complete figure. I know that the State Board of Education said that to have an adequate and equitable system would cost $5 billion for a biennium. But the figures that we have seen are much lower than that. But again, that is only if you continue the present inefficient system and expense anywhere like that be necessary.
Where is the inefficiency in the system as you see it?
The inefficiency is, I guess, in at least five or six issues. First, in terms of the structure of districts, the legislature has created a system where one district pays 30 cents and gets as much as another district that pays $1.20. What that does is it does not allow the state to use the tax resources of that wealthy district. The district that's taxing at 30 cents and raising all that money is not taxing at the state average, is not bringing that money into the system. That's a waste of money. The formulas themselves are inefficient. $600 to $700 million is sent to richer districts that don't need it, and it's not sent to poor districts that do. At least two.
Is the answer in the legislature changing the formula?
That's part of the answer. That would certainly help. We don't think long-term that will solve it. It's going to be a combination of a change in the formulas and a change in the way that the local districts are required to tax. Remember, it's the legislature's decision to put onto the local districts the burden of bringing their part of the system. The difficulty is that is raised by those local districts from districts of wildly varying tax wealth. That is an inefficient use of resources.
Well, is our job just to declare it unconstitutional if that's what we decide to do, or is our job also to tell the legislature how they ought to write the law?
Well, somewhere in between the two. First, your job, we think, is to declare it unconstitutional. To go farther, I think you have to declare that the system has to be efficient based on some of the major findings in the district court's opinion, that you cannot waste money through the formula system. You have to do something about districts that have tremendous advantages based on their local property wealth, and you have to look at the total efficiency of the system. This is not a new issue, by the way. Back in 49, when the Gilmer-Aiken bill passed, they said that the structure of the system is inefficient. In the Conley Commission, chaired by Mr. Jaworski, they found the system wildly inefficient in terms of the use of resources. The evidence in this trial finds it inefficient.
So what you'd like for us to do is give them a hint about which, where it wouldn't be inefficient.
That would be very helpful. I think the district court did that. If you read the district court's opinion, there are many hints on where money was wasted in the present system, and that certainly would give the legislature guidance. We are not asking you to write a new school finance form. We don't think it's your job.
Councilman, I thought.
I'm glad to hear you say that.
New Jersey, I think, had a similar problem. In New Jersey, or some of the state, three of the justices of the court were appointed overseers of the education system and became czars of education. That was one criticism. Do you envision that?
No, we don't envision that at all. And that has not been the process in most of the states. That, by the way, only occurred after the legislature refused to move. To some extent, this is a relationship between the branches of our government. In other states, the Supreme Court has set a standard. The legislature has moved very quickly, come up with a system. That has been the end of the battle. In New Jersey, the legislature continues to say, we're not going to do it, we're not going to do it, we're not going to do it, and challenge the authority of the Supreme Court, and that's why they had to resort to those means. We don't see that happening here.
In some states, the plaintiffs have sued members of the legislature. The legislature is not a defendant in this cause. We therefore don't have a case in controversy with the legislature to require the legislature to do any particular deed. What remedy is justiciable that this court can order beyond the ordering State Board of Education and the Comptroller not to allocate any state money whatsoever to education?
I think the limit of the court's authority ultimately is that, is to say that the system is unconstitutional and that the controller and the treasurer and the state board cannot distribute funds. We are sure that given that, the legislature will respond. We do not see it as necessary to have them as a party to threaten them with contempt of court. Hopefully we will not have that sort of thing.
But in essence, you're asking us to make things worse in the hope that another branch of government will make things better.
No. We're asking you to improve the system. We would think that any sort of order to stop sending funds is inconceivable, and our plaintiffs aren't going to pursue that. That, though, is the only position your court has. Under Ex parte Young, back in 1908, the Supreme Court said that we cannot tell people exactly what to do in the legislative branch. We can just say what's constitutional or not. We can say they can't spend money on an unconstitutional system. In the states, it's not been necessary in most of these states to have the legislature as a party. We would hope that before they would let Dr. Kirby and Mr. Bullock go to jail, the legislature would respond. Although Dr. Kirby might disagree with that, I don't know. But we don't see that we're going to get to that issue. And it hasn't happened in the other states.
Mr. Kaufman, yes. With regard to remedies in this area, as you know, quite well, it was back in October of 1969 that three Texas federal judges gave the legislature another 2 years to do something about the school finance system. Even in concurring in rejecting the decision of those three Texas federal judges, Justice Stewart referred to our system as chaotic. There has been reference by Justice Gonzalez to the New Jersey cases where they've had Robinson 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 in the New Jersey Supreme Court. Is the order of the trial court sufficiently specific to give the legislature the guidance it needs in order to get the job done and to prevent the necessity of repeated involvement by this court as happened in New Jersey?
The district court set a very clear, broad standard, but did not give details. And I think that was the proper course.
clearly would have made it possibly simpler if the district court had listed 10 principles that must be met. My understanding, and we don't recommend that he list those principles, just set a very definite standard. Our hope would be that if there's an affirmative of the district court standards, the legislature can read that, we can read that, we know what it means, that they will meet that standard. Certainly it would make it simpler for them if there were a list of 10 principles that must be met. But again, given the relationship among the branches, we do support the idea of a strong, clear statement first. If the legislature does not move forward, we might well have to come back and ask for a more detailed statement. It's going to depend on a good faith relationship between the branches.
Given the generation of children that have already gone through our schools during the time that this litigation and its predecessor case were pending, how quickly should we urge the legislature to act?
Well, the court order gave the legislature until September 1st, 89 to devise a new plan. That, of course, is unlikely given our present date. But it also said by 1990 the plan had to be implemented, and it needs to be done by then. Something has to be started no later than 1990. We would prefer an earlier resolution, some earlier interim relief. The State Board of Education about 4 months ago passed a resolution and said that the present system is leading to the financial ruin of school districts. We have several of our plaintiffs and plaintiff interveners who literally have no money left, and this time are faced with laying off teachers or reducing salaries, and will get worse next year. So we would hope for some immediate relief. The students starting now get out in the year 2000. So we would hope to at least in the next century to improve the system and improve our state at that level. In terms of the relationship among the districts and these tax rates, I think the story of North Forest is quite important in that they pay twice the tax rate of, almost twice the tax rate of Deer Park and spend 50% less. It also has a cycling effect. It is now more difficult for North Forest to attract industry, to attract businesses, because they have higher taxes and lower expenditures. So we are tied into the system, and that's one of the effects of the school finance system. In San Elizario, one of our plaintiffs, they have a $1.07 tax rate. They have no chemistry, no physics, calculus, foreign languages, pre-kindergarten, college prep, no extracurricular, no band, choir, football, no debate. They have 96% low-income students. Those students are not being given a chance in the society. The one more thing I want to do on the facts, I'm about to run out of time on the issues, is to explain to you briefly how the system works, the interaction of the local property wealth and the state funding. And I want to compare EdCalDelta, a district of 4,000 students, and Highland Park, a district of 4,000 students. EdCalDelta raises $2 a student for each penny tax rate. Highland Park raises $100 a student for each penny tax rate. If you have a 50-cent tax rate, then Highland Park raises $5,000. EdCalDelta raises $100. Now, the state does give much more money to EdCalDelta. It sends a check for more money. EdCalDelta about $2,600, Highland Park around $300. When you add them together, though, Highland Park has $5,300, EdCalDelta has $2,700, twice as much money at the same tax rate. But the importance is even further, and there is an issue of local control in this case. The defendants will make much of it. Let's talk about local control at the school board level. If this Supreme Court were a school board here, your superintendent, Mr. Vasquez, comes to you and speaks and says, we want a new problem for dropout, a new program for dropouts. It's going to cost $500 a student to have more tutors, more teachers, after-school programs, and counselors with the students. If you're in Highland Park, you go to your superintendent, comes to you as a school board, you ask him, how much is that going to cost in taxes? He says 5 cents. If you go to EdCalDelta, you ask, how much will this cost in taxes? He'll say 250. Now, which one of those boards has control? Which one of those boards can respond to the local populace? Which one of those boards can do something to help the people in their district? And the answer is fairly clear. Only the wealthy districts have that flexibility, that local control. Now, I've given you the extremes. Lawyers are often going to do that. The best case for the defendants is Edgewood versus Dallas. Even in that case, Edgewood spends less than Dallas, and state and local funds spend less. For Edgewood to spend as much as Dallas, they have to have a $1.30 tax rate against Dallas's 60 cents. But in addition, at a dollar tax rate, Dallas could spend $5,000. Edgewood could still only spend $3,200. So again, one has local control and one does not. I want to spend some time looking at the language of the Constitution because we think our case is so clear from it. First, if you look at the preamble to the Bill of Rights, it talks about the general, great, and essential principles. The word essential is important because it's the same word used in Article 1, 7, Section 1, talking about the importance of education in our society. In the Equal Rights provision, there are two phrases there. One is a positive one, one is a negative one. One says all people have equal rights, the other says no set of men have special rights. If you look at this system, the children in low-wealth districts do not have equal rights. And what is worse, the people in the wealthiest districts have special privileges. And that has been instituted by the state legislature. Going on to Article 1, Article 7, Section 1, there are five or six crucial phrases in that. The first one, a general diffusion of knowledge being essential to the preservation of the liberties and rights of the people. Extremely important phrase. We feel that it says from day one, we the founders, the framers of the Texas Constitution feel that education is crucial. Education is essential is the word they use. The same word they use in the preamble of the Bill of Rights. They have stated from day one, this is what this state is about. As a matter of fact, as one of the conditions for the entry of Texas into the Union was that they could continue an educational system. It goes on to say that it shall be the duty of the legislature. Crucial language. It doesn't say the duties on anyone else. It says the duties on the legislature to make suitable provision. Now, we're going to hear about Article 7, Section 3, another section of the Constitution, which gives the legislature the power to create school districts, the power to allow them to tax. Article 7, Section 3 does not say that local districts have the control of the school districts. It does not say that the state must allow them to tax. It says the state may allow them to tax.
Counsel, let's talk a little bit about this creation of school districts. How many school districts do we have in Texas at the turn of the century?
There are about 10,000 at the turn of the century.
And how many did we have at the time Gilmer Aiken was passed in 1940?
I think it was around 1,500 or 1,600 at that time.
And we're now down to a little less than 1,100?
That's correct.
So the trend has been consistent since the turn of the century to reduce the number of school districts.
That is correct. However, under the present system, there still is a good deal of wasted money in terms of going to small and inefficient school districts as well as poor school districts. In addition, back in the Jaworski Committee report in the late 1960s, they suggested a system of about 350 to 400 districts. So in terms of efficiency related to the use of districts, it's a well-known issue in this state. But the trend is certainly going toward fewer districts. Yes, sir. Given my limited time, I want to really jump into the standards of equal protection that we have to apply here. I know that there are at least three ways that have been talked about in other courts. And in this court, one is the strict scrutiny standard, one is the mid-level or middle-tier standard, and one is rational basis. We feel we went under all three. The undisputed facts of this case state that there are tremendous interests of the plaintiffs, there are classifications made that hurt them, and that the state's proffered excuses are not sufficient to justify the discrimination. But each one of these has some common things in it, and I think we need to talk about it. First, what are the classifications and what are the interests that are implicated by the system? The second is, what are the state's interests, either the real interest as in statute or constitution, or even the ones they come up with in a court case? And the third is the degree of the relationship. In terms of the classifications, education is involved. Education was in the Texas Declaration of Independence. It's been in every Texas Constitution. It's essential to the rights and liberties of the people. The Court of Appeals in this case stressed that we don't say education is like other things. It certainly is very special and crucial to us. In terms of the classes, let's talk about the classes. These districts are separated out through the state system. Who lives in them? The concentration of people in the poorest districts are poor people, and they are minority people. Most important thing is, they are children. They have not done anything to deserve this system.
whatever you might want to visit upon their parents, saying that their parents could move or their parents could raise taxes. The children themselves are certainly innocent of any of this. They were born in a place, they're educated in a place, and they are consigned to the education that they get there under the state system. There are poor people in these districts, minorities, and disadvantaged. So those are the classes that are implicated here. What are the state's interests? The state's interest is in the Constitution. It says a general diffusion of knowledge is essential. The state must have an efficient system. The state legislature has passed a general law on state policy. It says the provision of education is a state responsibility, that they must have a thorough and efficient system.
You mean in the statute?
In the statute, that's correct. But those, as far as we can see, are the justifications for the state system. During the trial, they have come up with the idea of local control and that that is implicated. The findings of the court, and I think the logic of the situation, is that local control is not compromised by an equalized system. And other Supreme Courts have said exactly that. They have said it is not going to reduce local control if all districts have the same rights.
Do you agree that a community can choose to tax itself more, to spend more on education than another community wants to?
Yes, I certainly do.
So you don't disagree that if a particular district in the state wanted to raise its own tax rate because it felt education was more important than another district, that it should have the right to do that?
I agree with that, and the district court specifically allowed for that. The district court judgment said that that is the case. Our issue is, though, some districts to raise it 5 cents to have this dropout program, and another district raise it 250 to have the dropout program. We want each district to have the same flexibility, the same local control, and that's our issue. We're not saying, and the court didn't say, that districts cannot raise or lower their taxes. The court made a very careful balancing. It looked at the duties of the state in the Constitution under Article 7, Section 1. It looked at the duties of the state under the Equal Protection and Due Process Clause. Then it looked at Article 7, Section 3, which talks about the legislature may create school districts and may allow them to tax. All of these things put together, and it created a system. It said you can have districts, they can have their own tax rates, but they have to have equal ability. They have to have an equal ability to raise funds, the same ability to raise funds as any other district. And that's well within our issue. Given my limited time, I wanted to talk about two other issues very quickly. One is under efficiency. We have a definition of efficiency, which is the one used in the dictionary at the time the Constitution was passed. And I think if you'll listen to this, you'll get a good idea of where efficiency was in the minds of the framers. At least I thought I had it. I don't. I'll read it later. Excuse me. The other issue is due process. We do feel that the system denies due process, due course of law to people in districts. It assigns them a duty to raise funds for their system, which they cannot meet. The district court found that districts cannot afford to meet the needs, the requirements of the state. It limits their access to wealth that they have helped to build up. And under the Love v. Dallas decision, a due course of law does apply in a situation like this.
Doesn't your position come down to this, that either the state has to spend more money on the education and distribute it per capita across the state, or else the district lines have to be redrawn so that the tax base in the districts is more nearly the same, or some combination of the two?
No. There are a lot of other options that are available without requiring either one of those. One is to change the formulas themselves as they stand would move $600 to $700 million toward the four districts.
But was asked earlier whether Judge Clark didn't find that the top end is adequate. And if you just move money out of the top and the bottom end, you're making it all inadequate, aren't you? You're making it all inadequate.
No. You certainly would move toward a more equitable system, but it would not be an equitable one by just moving that money. There are other ways, though. The courts in the state have approved of the concept of using county
county districts for the raising of funds to spend on schools, so that the entire wealth of the county would be pooled together at some tax rate, and that money could be spent on the schools. There's a lot of things that are taxed. Some of it is not equally distributed around the state. If some of those matters, such as oil and gas, were not taxed ad valorem by the school districts, but were brought, the money were brought forth by some other method, that could be distributed equitably. We do not feel that you have to change the district lines. Certainly the tax haven districts have been a sore in the side of the state for a long time, and probably something should be done with them. But other than that, no massive change would be necessary. In the area of attorney's fees, we again pursue our issue.
Counsel, before you move on to attorney's fees, you're going to speak to us about efficiency. And I think your brief indicates that in 1877, efficient men using resources so as to produce results with little waste. Will you speak to that?
Yes, sir. In 1876, time passes in the Constitution. Efficiency meant productive, capable, producing, efficacious. It did not mean cheap or economical or centrally controlled, as the defendants have tried to argue here. We look at first the dictionary definition, but then if you look at the debates, you'll find that the word efficiency, by the way, efficiency is also used in the Bill of Rights for juries. It talks about a creation of an efficient jury system. Certainly the word means more than economical and cheap. Our feeling is that the way to create an efficient system, as I said before, is not to allow these massive disparities of wealth or the allocation of unfair resources. That efficient use at that time meant something that works. It is not wasted. It is effective, efficacious. And under that definition, this present system certainly is not an efficient one. Several other state Supreme Courts have looked at their systems under their efficiency clauses and found them not because of these same issues, as well as a sense that to be efficient, you have to be equitable. And this Supreme Court, back in 1931, drew that comparison as well. They said a school finance system then would create both efficiency and equity. We appreciate your hearing our issue. We look forward to an early decision in our favor, and we hope that you do what we all want to do, which is to help the kids of the state of Texas. Thank you.
May it please the court, Mr. Richard Gray III, will present 20 minutes of argument, Mr.
Christian. May it please the court. My name is Rick Gray. I, along with David Richards, represent 55 core school districts. The issue before you today, gentlemen, is far more than school districts. We are talking about the future of millions of children.
Speak a little louder.
Yes, sir. We're talking about the future of millions of children. There are roughly 3 million children in today's system. 1.5 million attend below average wealth districts. The system we have today divides this room, if you will, puts 1.5 million children on one side, 1.5 million children on the other side, through no reason whatsoever other than the happenstance of their geographic location. But then what it does is the people who happen to be lucky, their parents pay a low tax rate, and yet they get a tremendous quality education.
Counsel, are you advocating absolute equality on the amount of funds spent for children?
No, sir. What I'm advocating...
What deviation would be permissible under your theory of the case?
Substantial equality, and I would personally... Yes, I personally would agree up to a 10% deviation, no more. And what we have is we have districts here where you have wild wealth fluctuations. And the reason we have that, Justice Spears, is because the reliance that's put on the local property tax base. When you have districts that range from $20,000 of wealth per student up to $14 million per student, you're going to have huge disparities based strictly upon the happenstance of geographic
location. Oh, I understand that argument. I understand it. And it's briefed well in your briefs. My concern was, how far does the legislature, assuming we would agree with you, how far does the legislature have to go to make it equal? Absolutely equal?
No, sir.
You'd give a 10% deviation?
I personally would agree to a 10% deviation.
You permit now, 10% inequality?
Now, it is, and that's what I'm saying. I'm not here telling you that the Constitution provides for deviation for anybody. The Constitution, as I read it, should provide that all people are treated equally across the board. But
they
there are certain practical...
They have the last dime.
Well, that's what I'm saying. There are certain practical realities that we all have to face in the implementation of a constitution and of a school finance system. And then we have to find, where do you draw that line?
Well, that really gets ahead of this case.
It does get ahead of this case. And I think that, hopefully, will never come before this court. But the second aspect of this case, if the legislature should fail to do what the legislature is mandated to do, will be to have that in later determined.
But Mr. Kaufman argues that a difference of even $100 or $200 per student can be significant. I take it you agree with that.
I do agree with that. I agree with it in all the superintendents, I believe, both in wealthy districts and in poor districts across the state will agree with that.
So that whatever system the legislature should come up with that would meet the Constitution's requirements, in your view, that the disparity would have to be smaller than that.
Yes. Should be. And just a second, responding to one of the questions you asked, Mr. Kaufman, dealing with district lines, new influx of state money, or a combination there of the two, plaintiff interveners believe it can be solved and should be solved with a combination of the two. District lines in Texas, for better or for worse, have been viewed to be sacrosanct for years. Every study that has ever been done of this system, dating back to the 1930s, all the way through today, has found the system wildly inefficient based upon the reliance of local districts in their property tax base. You can, however, implement a system that does not change for operational purposes district lines one iota and at the same time be fair to all students.
Mr. Gray, are you suggesting the court do two things? First of all, rule the present system unconstitutional. And second, mandate the legislature, to use your term, mandate the legislature to come up with a system that allows only a 10% variation in tax resources in their allocation?
No, sir. All I'm asking is that this court declare the system unconstitutional, and I would suggest this court give guidance to the legislature or whomever should read the opinion as to what this court would consider to be a constitutional plan. I'm not advocating and not asking this court to mandate the legislature do anything. I share Mr. Kaufman's belief. Maybe it's naive, to be quite frankly, because the legislature has known of this problem for multiple generations. But I share Mr. Kaufman's belief that if this court should speak strongly and firmly and swiftly, that the legislature will respond. I happen to be a product of the unfair system. I am a 1969 graduate of Highland Park High School in Dallas. I currently am a product of the unfair system because my children attend school in the second wealthiest district in Travis County. And I'm going to take advantage of the system. And it's important to me that I got the education that I got, and it's important to me that my children get the education they're getting. But we have to look beyond self-interest. We have to look to the state as a whole. And we cannot continue to educate a second-class set of citizens. The competition both in the job market is too severe today. We're not only competing against other states. Primarily, we're competing against the Japanese, the West Germans, the Koreans. And they are destroying us. And it is courts like you that have to say enough is enough.
Mr. Gray,
what we're asking.
If the competition imposes such a clear duty on the legislature, what's your view on why they haven't discharged it in a long, long time?
Politics, pure and simple, just a second. And with all due respect to the legislature, you will find that by and large in your wealthy school districts, by and large reside your wealthiest people, who by and large happen to be your largest contributors, who by and large happen to have the greatest influence over members of the legislature. That is a political reality of where we are. And there are certain issues, I wish there weren't, but there are, that are such a political hot potato that only courts such as this court can deal with. And I am sad to say, but it's true, that this is one of them.
Why do you say that only bodies such as this court can deal with them? The legislature is elected by the people. And the Constitution of the United States starts off, we the people. Are they not the ones who are first obligated to deal with this situation?
Yes, sir, they are. And they've known of this problem and have had a chance to deal with this problem since 1930. And here we are in 1989, 59 years later, and the problem has not been dealt with. We're worse off, if anything. And there comes a point in time where the judicial branch, albeit possibly reluctantly, has to step forward and has to enforce the state constitution.
Have
and that's what we're doing.
During this entire period of time, not had the opportunity to remove the members of the legislature if they felt they were not fulfilling their constitutional mandate?
Sure. Sure they
have. They have the power to remove members of this court now.
That's true.
If they're not doing their duty.
That's true.
A power they would not have under an appointed system.
But as a practical matter, and I happen to believe that this court has to interpret this constitution irrespective of political ramifications, irrespective of party affiliation. I think the court has to exercise its judicial function and apply the Constitution as the Constitution is written.
There's one answer to Justice Cook's question. The fact that poor people, by and large, do not have an effective law?
They have no law, Justice Gonzalez. Poor people, by their very nature, are poor. And those of us that have been involved in the legislative process, and I was through General White's administration and Governor White's administration somewhat involved in that, your people who give you money, by and large, are people who have access and who you listen to.
Are you saying that the only people that have access to the legislature are those who can afford lobbyists?
No, I'm not saying those are the only people, but I'm saying that those are the people who have, unfortunately, the largest voice and who can afford to hire people to beat down the doors day in and day out. And I'm telling you, and I am saying to you, that there are too many school children who have no voice at all. And you are their last hope.
With reference to remedies, the district court order, of course, doesn't use the 10% figure that you used in referring to earlier questions. Given the long period of legislative inaction on this disparity, does the district court order, as currently drawn, provide sufficient guidelines to get the job done?
I believe it does. And the reason I believe it does is because what it says is, for an equal penny in tax rate, you, student in District A, are going to have the same amount of money available to be spent on your education than you in District B. We don't care how you, legislature, do that. What we care is that you make sure that all children have equal access to educational dollars and educational opportunity, limited only by the willingness of the taxpayers in each of those districts to tax themselves. Which goes back to your question, Justice Heck. We totally agree that if all districts are on equal footing, have the same opportunity, if
same district, tax base,
same tax base, or the equivalent by different tax bases and the difference made up by state funds, that you ought to, you as a district, ought to be able to make local control decisions.
An effort is made by the state now to supplement local funding of schools with state funds and to take into account the amount of state funds available in a particular, or the local funds available in a particular district. And do you just say at this point that doesn't go far enough?
Oh, it doesn't even come close. Yes, so that, and let me tell you why.
But if the legislature continued along that pattern, would that approach the system that you think the Constitution requires?
If they got it fixed, yes. They've had 50 some odd years to get it fixed, and the one thing we do know, what they did this last session, is a movement backwards. Mr. Kaufman didn't tell you the real numbers, or because he didn't have them off the top of his head. Inflation, since we tried this case, has made the gap $650 million bigger than it was when we tried it. The legislature has now appropriated $450 million. So the gap, since we tried this case, has grown $200 million. That's the hard reality of what we're dealing with. And it's going to grow larger next year, and larger next year, and larger the year after that. In responding to...
If you improve the schools that you say are disadvantaged, to give them the same spending per child
as the schools, you say, are advantaged, it's just going to take more money, isn't it? Don't we still just talk about more money?
You're talking more money, or you're talking about a combination of equalized tax bases?
Well, but the combination still has to generate more money than what's being spent
right
now, or else somebody's going to come down.
For example, look at Potter County, the map that we have there. In all these maps, you could look through county after county after county, and they're all in the appendix. They all were exhibits and admitted into evidence before the trial court. You find that is a typical example, but Potter County is not an aberration. You find the same thing in every metropolitan county in the state. You find it in North Texas, South Texas, East Texas, West Texas. You have districts side by side. One, dirt poor, which happens to be Amarillo, which filed an amicus brief on the petitioner's side, has all the students. Has of 24,000 students out of the entire 27,000 in the county. Yet, they don't have the money. There are adjacent districts, the Highland Park District, which, by the way, there's two Highland Parks in this state, both of which have extreme wealth and both of which are providing way above average expenditures for their children. You have that situation. No matter what standard of efficiency you apply, no matter what standard of equality you apply, it doesn't make any sense.
And it's
certainly not equality under the Constitution.
You used the phrase equalized tax basis.
Yes.
If we equalize the tax basis of the school districts, aren't we just completely throwing out all the whole concept of local control, the reason for the way our system has developed?
No, sir.
How can you equalize the tax basis when you have such unequal in geographical area and resources and available tax revenue?
I can tell you exactly. Two things. You can draw, and we drew for the trial court, what we call regional tax districts that happen to mirror the existing regional service centers that TEA administers right now the whole education system under.
Then we take out the control of the taxes. We'd still have the local district could hire the superintendent and that sort of thing.
You have all
as
the
far
same
as
operational
the tax structure
control.
Is concerned, the school board would lose all of its function.
Well, you have a larger function. You have a school board for the regional tax authority. And Justice Hightower, the concept of local control for a poor district is a very cruel myth. Poor districts, they don't have the money to have any frills. All the decisions they get to make is which state mandate do we ask for a variance for, or which need do we go without. And under the concept of local control as a whole, all it possibly can mean under today's system is the ability to make decisions on spending money. And if you're poor and you don't have the money, you have no decision.
Well, I understand that. I just want to be sure that I understood what we were talking about when we say we're going to equalize the tax district.
Yes.
Counsel, I want to ask one question before your time gives out. It's about to. You're basing most of your arguments on the Texas Constitution. Your opposition is basing most of their arguments on the federal Constitution. Are you putting all your eggs in one basket, or do you want us to consider your pleas under both constitutions?
We are playing this case and urging this case to the Texas Supreme Court under the Texas Constitution. And I urge you to look at the resolution adopted by the defendant, State Board of Education, February 11, 1989, 5 months ago, and they set it out facts. We have districts that are going bankrupt. It's inequitable, it's not adequate. We have fact findings that are unchallenged and undisputed that one third of the school children in this state under this financing system are not getting an adequate education.
But Mr. Gray, let me come back to this. Doesn't this come down to either spend more money in the state on education or else reduce the quality of the schools that have the highest funds and try to bring up the quality of the schools that have the lowest funds to somewhere in the middle? Aren't those the two alternatives?
I understand your characterization. I don't agree with it.
Well,
because you have districts like Highland Park. How in the world is the Highland Park in Potter County with over $1 million per student and only 500 students, how is that serving any educational purpose? That's a tax haven, Justice Huck.
It may or it may not, even if it's a tax haven, you're advocating a position that taxes that property more.
Yes, it makes no sense to me, and I can't see it, but there are 30-some-odd cents. And when Mr. Richards gets up, you're going to see some counties that are down to 9 cents.
I understand your argument.
And that is, it cannot be, under any concept, that does not make sense.
Consolidation would solve part of the problem, wouldn't it?
It would solve it all. I'm not saying advocating consolidation, but I'm saying that if you equalize tax bases and you give either by direct consolidation, by regional tax districts, or by making up the difference out of state funds, but if you put all students and all taxpayers on an equal footing, where 50 cents in District A gets the same as 50 cents in District B, all you're doing is enforcing the state constitution, you're treating people equally, and you're providing for an adequate education for the kids.
Counselor, I want to talk about this state board education resolution. Is that the same resolution that was passed earlier in the year where the state board, as I recall, advocated a 5-year phase-in plan to achieve 95%?
Yes, yes, sir.
And that was the elected state board of education?
Yes, sir. And the State Board of Education has advocated a phased-in plan over time, which Justice Clark recognized would be likely a necessity. They put a price tag on it. If you don't do anything, if you just want to throw new state money into it and let the tax havens survive, don't do anything as far as creating or correcting all the inefficiencies in the system, it will cost about $5 billion.
Basically, the plan that the Senate Education Committee recommended and that the Senate passed 31-0 for the first 2 years of phase in over a 6-year period, I believe, rather than a 5-year period, was it not?
It was very close to Senator Parker's plan, I believe, Justice Mossy. I can't honestly respond to you.
But of course, that plan didn't make it all the way through the legislative process. It was cut back because all the money had been spent before they got to education, as usual.
Yes, sir. And as I'm afraid will continue to be the case unless somebody steps forward and says enough is enough.
Is that $5 billion figure a biennium or
biennium? Biennium, I believe.
Mr. Gray, you gave us whereases here in the State Board of Education resolution, but you did not give us a bid resolve. What was it that they wanted to resolve?
They wanted equity up to a 95% level. They did not agree for a 10% toleration. They wanted 95%. They went on to talk about facilities being included, which we haven't dealt with, but it's an issue that assumes a lot of this argument. They dealt with the money, the $5 billion. I believe they wanted $1.5 billion immediately, and the rest phased in.
It's a response to one of your briefs, isn't it? I can't. Yeah. The reply brief.
Mr. Gray, with regard to the issue of local enrichment, do I understand that it is your position and the position taken by the findings and conclusions of the trial court that there's no opposition to local enrichment if you have a tax equalized system?
That's correct, Mr. Starr. What we believe is that if everybody is on the same footing, if a local district wants to tax themselves more and provide extras, we encourage that.
So a limited disparity in funding levels among districts that was related solely to tax effort would not present a constitutional problem if you had a tax equalized system?
We don't believe so. In fact, we believe that's what's contemplated in Article 7, Section 3. I know we're running out of time, but in follow-up, in response to Justice Mossy's earlier question to Mr. Kaufman, in follow-up to yours, at the time all this was done, we had between 11,000 and 10,000 school districts out here, all of which were rural, all of which had almost the exact same tax base. We started with an equalized tax system. What has happened over time is we've evolved to this vastly unequalized system. All we're asking is that the court, through guidance, strongly suggest that we need to go back to what the founders of our Constitution had in mind, which is equal bang for the buck.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Court will now take a brief recess.
Please rise.